Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
Stop the Killing is proud to be supported by our sponsor, Easy PA. Easy PA is an integrations-capable communication software that connects older building systems, such as signage and public address systems, to modern software technologies, such as panic alarms and mass communication systems. Go to easypa.com, that's EZYPA.com, to learn how to integrate your systems today.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing. Welcome to another episode of Stop the Killing. Catherine, how are you?
I'm dandy. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
I'm rip-roaring ready to go with some fascinating facts about a case. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say we all remember.
Yeah.
We don't actually remember any of the details. Before we start, though, I wanted to just say a big shout out to, I hope I'm going to pronounce her name properly, but we have a new Patreon, a person who actually has sponsored us for the year, which,
yay,
bless her, Michelle Brzozowski, I think it's pronounced. And if I get that wrong, Michelle, you just send us a phonetic correction and I'll correct it on the next recording. But that is wonderful to have somebody who says, I believe in what you're doing and I'm committed the year to you. So thank you so, so, so much.
We appreciate it. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, Michelle is waiting for her year's worth of content. So let's give her a really...
Let's get her started.
This particular case we're talking about is set in Oslo. So we're doing an international case today.
It was July 22nd of 2011 attack in Norway. This is very much political violence. And I will say that overall, this is the deadliest mass shooting that has ever occurred on Earth. And that is striking. And that's why other shooters admire him. Isn't that sad? So the 32-year-old shooter, what a surprise, that age, right? The
32-year-old. I was going to say bang on there, isn't it, in terms of average age.
This guy perpetrated in one day a massive car bomb explosion, and then 2 hours later traveled by ferry to commit another massive attack at this island.
That is not a little bit of light planning.
No, this is years of planning. And so, you know, how did he orchestrate that?
Yeah, who saw?
How did he fly under the radar? Who saw? There was essentially a car bomb explosion near the executive government quarters in Norway. Now, car bomb, you're like, oh, car bomb. This car bomb was 950 kilograms.
Wow.
Of a car bomb.
What?
Yeah.
I don't know how you make a car bomb, but that sounds ridiculously, heavy and huge.
Right. So in here, it would be a ton. In the States, in terms of pounds, it was 2,100 pounds. So this car bomb was so big, he had to build it and put it in like a van, you know, that you would transport workers. And so it is this huge car bomb. This is one of the first things I wanted to just mention is that we know that he has become like the Columbine shooters, another person to emulate in terms of copycats. What he perpetrated in Oslo, 8 people killed and 209 injured just from the car bomb, 12 severely injured. And he intended to kill, if he could, government heads in Norway. That was the intent. This first explosion was outside the executive quarters right near the office of the prime minister. And it is his political philosophy that we later learn about that prompts a lot of this. So a car bomb blows up in this very populated area of the city center, and it occurs at 1525. It was parked right next to the housing for the office of the prime minister. He pulls this vehicle up into this spot. He's in a police uniform. It appears to be a police uniform.
Yeah.
And so less suspicious.
Yeah. And already got authority.
Mm-hmm. And he sits 15 or 20 seconds in this van. And then he suddenly gets out of the van and he walks away. In fact, to a car that he has placed someplace else. All kinds of pre-planning, right? And the people in Norway are busy frantically, right? Trying to figure out, okay, what's going on? And the explosion isn't just near the prime minister's office. It is near the headquarters for the Ministry of Justice and police. So like everybody who's anybody is right there in the government offices. The fire and the explosion was so massive. It blew all the windows out on all the floors of all the buildings around there. All the video camera footage shows nothing but like billowing smoke throughout the entire area, right? And so when the police get the message, they don't know what's going on and they run to the scene and they are just beginning to kind of get a handle on the mess that is. There has to be a confirmation that the prime minister is still alive. There are all these kinds of things. Traffic is unmanageable. They're struggling to try to get the resources and transport people and find medical care for these severely injured people and find the people who died. You can imagine that when something like that happens, the first hour or two is pretty hectic.
Chaos, I think, would be raining down.
You know, you're almost like never prepared for it. Your military prepares for this kind of violence, the depth of injury and unexpected injury to the heart of the city, who are the people who make the decisions, right? When I first thought about that, I was thinking, how's a good comparison to that? When the first two planes went into our buildings in New York City on 9/11 in 2001, one of the results of the planes going down in New York City and take the buildings down and all the damage done is that the FBI's field office, which is the largest FBI office in the world, went down. It had to be shut down. It was damaged. They couldn't operate there. And in fact, the FBI ran the investigation for 9/11 in New York City out of their garage. That's the biggest investigation ever. So here is the Ministry of Police, you know, the Prime Minister's office, all these are damaged. Windows are blown out. There's smoke and chaos everywhere. And you're looking for the people in charge to make the decisions about what to do also, right? So it was really crazy. So while they're dealing with that, our suspect has climbed in a car and driven out of town. In this time period of chaos, he's calmly driving his car north because 90 minutes later, he gets on a ferry. And he takes it over to this island where this youth camp is held every summer.
I remember watching a movie version of this. And my feeling from the island was it was literally an island that you would just walk around. And the sense that I got from that movie, and it may be wrong, was that really that meant there wasn't that many places to hide.
I think that's a fair assessment. And if you take it from the perspective of the person who's doing the shooting, he is able to walk around and hunt down people. And that is what he did. And that's what made this even more horrific, if that's even possible to say. I mentioned the prime minister was not killed, but I will tell you that this was a youth camp for the political party. And so among the people who were killed were friends of the prime minister's and even the stepbrother of the Norway's crown princess. So people who were very established and known, and not that matters at all.
And life's a life, but I think probably the point there is that his goal was to get those people.
Right. He spends an hour and a half getting from the Oslo explosion to the ferry in his uniform, presents false credentials as a police officer, and boards the ferry. the lake, as I mentioned, is 20 miles or 32 kilometers northwest of Oslo. And this is where the Norwegian Labour Party's youth camp is. And it holds every summer there. They have this event that's held, and there are usually about 500 to 600 teens at the campsite every year.
Wow.
And he knows about this, so he comes with a lot of ammunition. He presents himself as a police officer, as I mentioned, and the camp leader and the security officer meet him and talk to him. And very quickly, I think there is some suspicion, perhaps, and he kills them, both of them. So now the leadership is gone, right? And he kind of continues to move on as a law enforcement officer, and he begins to tell people to gather around. He said, hey, I'm checking on the youth camp because this big explosion just happened in Oslo. And
yeah.
So it makes sense that maybe some...
Yeah, extra security's coming.
Security's coming just to check it out. So he's kind of thought this through, right? And then all of a sudden, as people begin to gather around, which are mostly teens, he begins to pull weapons and ammunition from this bag that he's carrying with him, and he just firing indiscriminately at anybody who's standing near him. And he just continues to fire. He's killing so many people that he is beginning to lose track of people that he can still keep killing and shooting. So he's shooting, shooting, shooting. There are people who are playing dead. He comes back to them and he shoots them again because he wants to make sure everybody's dead.
So nightmarish. So nightmarish.
Yes. And these are people who are teens, early 20s, I think would probably be the latest. Some of them are jumping in the water and trying to swim away because it's not a big island, right? So there are some who are jumping in the water and they begin to swim. He's shooting at people in the water because he wants to shoot as many people as he can. So shooting, shooting, and he's finding more ammunition and he's changing magazines and different guns, right? And he actually, surprisingly, he lets a 11-year-old child go for some reason. And I say for some reason, but the subject survives. Police eventually arrest him. And he explains later that the kid was too young to die. I don't know what the logic is in that, right? He'd already shot the guy's dad.
Right.
And then he decided, oh, well, this kid's too young, so I'm going to let the kid go. That was his explanation later. There was even a 22-year-old who survived who said he begged for his life, so the guy didn't shoot him. So why? Maybe somebody connected with him. Emotionally,
yeah.
Right? He got this emotional connection at some point with somebody for a moment, and that allowed somebody to survive. And I think we see that with shooters who plan in their mind, they plan on shooting. They don't see the people they're shooting sometimes, you know, we know, and that makes them, as they disassociate themselves with human beings, it's easier for them to kill them because they focus on their rage or what they're angry about. So for 90 minutes, this guy is shooting all over the place. And the people on the island, the kids, mostly teens on the island, are scrambling to try to find ways to survive. The shooter was using what law enforcement uses, hollow point bullets that fragment inside the body and they cause a lot more damage. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was yelling at them while he was shooting at them. You're going to die. You're going to die. You guys are Marxists. You guys are liberals. You're going to die. You think you're the elite. So he's espousing all of his political beliefs. Yeah. And he continues to shoot for an hour and a half. Here's one of those great stories. Maybe I'll hold it to the end, but a great survivor story.
Tell me now. I feel like I need a good survivor story now. This is pretty horrific.
Okay. 47 of the campers hid in the schoolhouse. And what have I always said is the most important thing about schools?
Those doors?
Safety. Yeah, doors. 47 people hid in the schoolhouse to be safe. And then he tried to get in the door. He couldn't get in the door. And they survived.
Wow.
Doors. Locked doors. Man, lock the doors. That's what I always say. Lock the doors. So 47 people. He fired 2 bullets through the door, but he didn't get through the locked door. And all the people inside the building survived.
It surprises me how much of a deterrent the doors are sometimes to people. Like we've seen in Sandy Hook, where just having something over the window was a deterrent.
It's just about the course of least resistance.
Yes, because actually, if somebody wanted to make the effort to get through those doors, they could have with probably the firepower they haven't. So yeah, I think that's a really great illustration of get the doors locked.
Get away if you can. Get the doors locked if you can. Go. You know, this I know was a 90-minute shooting event, which is incredibly unusual. I can think of two more like that in my lifetime. But those momentary situations that make a shooter choose to go someplace else. So when those people are in the room, right, he's looking for how many people can I kill? How many people can I shoot? And he puts a couple rounds. He can't get through that door. He's got a whole island of kids. He can chase a whole bunch of people. So he starts moving around to chase other people. And there are kids literally jumping in the water and swimming to other places on the island to be safe, including a number who hid in a cave. And they're just looking for just any place else where they can survive. And you realize after the fact that immediately word begins to go out that this is happening. Even though it's on an island, the news gets out and law enforcement is now also on alert. And they're trying to figure out, okay, we need to get there. There were a bunch of teenagers who found this cave and there were like 36 of them who hid inside this cave. And even the person who was kind of keeping guard at the doorway was fishing people out of the water as they brought people in with the idea that eventually somebody will come to save us. Can you imagine being in that position?
I mean, it's just terrifying. And now a word from our sponsor.
EasyPA is an integration-capable communication software that connects older building systems, such as signage and public address systems, to modern software technologies, such as panic alarms and mass notification systems. Additional features include built-in automated bell schedules, remote access, text-to-natural voice announcements, and custom audio playlists. EasyPA is one of the only full-service public address and communications companies that has in-depth knowledge on both the hardware and software aspects of communication and evacuation-based products. As a solution-based company, they offer design, supply, installation, and maintenance of all their products. And for use in schools, EasyPA software provides multi-zone capabilities, pre-scheduled daily announcements and bells, and a remote alert button that can be accessed from anywhere in the school. Once a panic alarm is triggered, law enforcement is notified immediately. EasyPA makes schools safer from any threat. Go to easypa.com. That's E-Z-Y-P-A. .com to learn how to integrate your systems today. If you want to be a reseller or integrations partner, visit easypa.com to learn more. That's easypa.com.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Remember I said this was a political attack? I didn't know this. And I learned later. That day, shortly before he came over on the ferry, there was a former prime minister there on the island giving a speech, and he had 20 minutes of travel to get to the ferry, but it took him 90 minutes to get to the island, and she had left by then. So from a politics standpoint, right? And he had said in his writings how he hated this person. He hated this person. So after, when he was arrested during his trial, he said, well, my plan was to go kill her on the island.
Just her?
No, her and others.
Okay.
But he altered his plan. Once he got there and she wasn't there, he was like, okay, I'll just kill everybody else.
Wow.
So, I mean, just incredible, because she had already left because all of the delays and the rail stations and everything had caused this like total difference.
And I wonder also
timing for him.
Did the island know about the Oslo Central attack by that stage?
They did know that the shooting occurred, right? But then how do you get there, right? That's the problem. So they put a police tactical unit in a helicopter or in automobiles. They're headed in that direction. And civilians began arriving, right? Like one of the first to arrive was a civilian who recognized the sound of gunshots.
To the island?
To the island. This particular, you know, guy, he's a German resident and he is staying on the mainland, but he pilots his boat to the island and begins throwing life jackets to young people in the water. He went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth until the police said, okay, stop. Okay, stop. We don't need you to do this anymore. He was throwing life jackets to kids and pulling people out of the water and stuff like that. There are just so many people who are just trying to, you know, rescue people. It was very quick that the people knew that something bad had happened, but it took a while for law enforcement to get there. They estimate that 150 kids actually swam from the island and were pulled out of the lake. 150 kids were pulled out of the lake on the opposite shore. They swam the distance that people usually take a ferry to get, right? So pretty crazy. So there's this huge effort to kind of pull people out of the water. People swam over across the island. And law enforcement finally shows up on the island, They pull their guns out. They're going to find this bad guy.
The guy's been walking around in a police officer's uniform.
That's right. They do not know if these are real police officers.
Wow. And
they're begging them to drop their guns because all these people have been murdered by a police officer. So the law enforcement faces this extra problem, right? And then we find out historically that, in fact, the subject has twice phoned law enforcement to give himself up. Twice.
What? Stop.
Yes.
In that 90-minute time frame, he's phoned.
Yes. The subject actually calls the emergency number twice. He calls twice to surrender. Law enforcement's not even at the scene yet. And then he hangs up, and then he keeps killing people.
Mm-hmm. What?
And then another 25 minutes goes by, and then he calls back. And he's like, I'm ready to surrender. And then he hangs up, and then he keeps killing people. Yes. Yes, exactly. So police get to the scene, but when they find the subject, he actually like gives himself up, which is, seems weird.
Unusual.
Right?
Mm,
but
heard
not
of.
Really, right? I mean, we've seen it before, right? We've seen
Aurora Theater.
Aurora Theater. There you go. Right. I mean, we've seen shooters who just drop their gun and then police arrest them. So by the time he shoots a bunch of people, he's finished his plan. So now he's like, okay, I'm done. And he calls to give himself up. But, you know, there's no police officer standing right next to him that apparently makes him feel like he could just do that. So he hangs up and he starts shooting more people for 25 more minutes.
I mean, you've got to think too, like you say, you know, as we've spoken about before, they're normally over these shootings in sort of, 2 to 5 minutes. 90
right.
minutes. Am I right in saying, did you say 90 minutes he was on the island shooting? Like
it's
that's a long, long, long time.
Can you,
a long time.
You keep your adrenaline up for 90 minutes, right? To keep yourself up and motivated and going and your adrenaline going and everything else. You know, I think in the beginning, it was probably kind of coming off the way he thought in some ways. But then it became a chore and he was just looking for his out. And unfortunately, he chose an event in a location that was very difficult for law enforcement to get to quickly. And he didn't have the moxie. That's what we would say here in the States. He didn't have the moxie.
I would say he's not human enough.
Yeah, he's not human enough to just drop his weapons and give himself up. So that was super horrible. There's like two tragedies. There's the tragedy that he commits on the island, and then the tragedy that ensues afterwards as they try to find survivors and transport people who are injured to medical care when there is no ability to do that, right? Oh, they're putting people on anything they can find and rafts and transporting them across to the mainland to try to get to someplace where they can get medical care.
You haven't spoken much about the numbers on the island that are injured. How many are we speaking? Because you're already thinking, okay, well, you've got 209 people that are injured in Oslo itself, flooding right. the A&Es. So, what else have we got coming?
So from the island, the good part is there are 517 survivors. Remember, I told you there were about 600 people. So do the math, right? 66 of those survivors were wounded. So 69 people killed. And also, remember, we had eight killed.
Yeah.
In the bombing. Seven. Right. So 77 people killed, which they finally had a death toll on July 29th, which was a week later. And does that explain why it took us that long to get that death toll? Right. Yeah. Because we had kids who were unaccounted for, who jumped into lakes, you know, were shot while they were in the water, hiding here, hiding there. And also the other thing about the bombing, I think, is really important to remember is in television and movies, it is an enclosed area and you know where everybody is. When a chaotic situation occurs, like a bombing or a shooting, people scatter and there is no legal requirement for them to contact law enforcement. You know, you run to safety, you just run to safety. So it takes a long time for law enforcement to kind of account for who was there. How do you know who was there? And then were they, you know, were there 600 kids on the island or were there 602? Right. You know, so-and-so was on the attendance list for that event or supposedly was working on this day in this government building, but maybe they weren't. Maybe that person was at the dentist.
The other thing that I'm thinking as well is, like you said, like the death toll was days later, but presumably with this many people injured, there's deaths later after that marker in the sand.
Right. And so it wasn't just finding people. It was also people who weren't really sure if they were going to be on the wounded or killed side of the balance sheet.
Absolutely horrific.
In the final count, they figured out that there were 564 people actually on the island at the time of the shooting, 69 who we know were killed, 110 who received some sort of physical injury, 50 people were treated locally at local hospitals. When I say a physical injury too, imagine if you are the kid who's a 15-year-old who takes off into the water and swims and climbs up into a cave, right? You could have physical injuries that aren't gunshot wounds. So it took them hours and hours to account for everybody on the island, get them all off and give them care. They gave some of the care on the island and some off. I mentioned this was a youth camp. The biggest groups of people who were killed were teens, 7 15-year-olds, 8 16-year-olds, 16 17-year-olds, and 17 18-year-olds. 49 people between the ages of 15 and 18 killed on the island.
Children.
49 children, right? 15 to 18 years old. And the youngest was 14. There were 14-year-olds. There were four adults, you know, over the age of 40 on the island who were killed. And a handful of counselors, you know, that were in their 20s.
You just, you know, I think of all of the times that you send your kids away to these like camps. I mean, political, by the by, whatever. We've all, if you've had children, had those moments where you've got to trust an adult to take your child to a camping experience if you're lucky enough to have that.
And I do think that part of the shock of this was that this would not be the kind of thing that you would think would be a risk to your child.
No.
You know, you're sending them someplace on an island that's safe where nobody's going to go there. And how would you think? And it, I say, you know, as a law enforcement officer, a long time in the law enforcement world, we always think the best of people. And as a law enforcement officer, I'm a little bit like, as former President Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. You know, you always make sure, you always double check because you don't get a second chance. And I think this is, you know, an example of you don't think that would happen. And this is really what emergency preparedness is all about. It's preparing for something that you wouldn't expect. And that's what you count on your emergency officials to do is prepare for something that is like the most ridiculous thing. Oh, a hurricane's going to come through. A tsunami is going to come through. And you want all of those things prepared in case. And so it's just super horrific incident. I wanted our listeners and you to, I wanted us to reflect on the different pieces that happened. Because this individual committed a full day of atrocities, but it took years for him to prepare for it. This subject was arrested live, wanted to have a trial that was publicly displayed on television, wanted to be able to wear a costume of his own choosing, meaning really? Like whatever that is, like police uniform or something. What's your deal? He acknowledged the shootings. He acknowledged the bombing, but they were unnecessary atrocities. That's what he called them. They were necessary.
And he was a lone actor in this.
He was a lone actor in this. Yeah. He chose to do this on his own, but he was prolific in his words, in his writings about his political views. He was very much a believer in a Christian nation. He was a white supremacist. Him here in the States.
Yeah.
And he believed in a Christian nation. We see oftentimes somebody who is a white supremacist or who is a Christian nationalist who is committed to acting violently to push their political beliefs forward. They often attack others. They attack the community that emigrates to their country, or they attack immigrants who come looking for political asylum, or they attack people who are generationally in their country but look different than they are. And he was very vocal in his writings about his belief that Muslims were bad, and you know, he didn't want to have any of that, you know, in his country. But he attacked the political parties that he felt allowed it to happen, which is a different kind of political attack than we see oftentimes. You know, there was, not surprisingly, because he was captured alive, there was initially a court forensic psychologist assigned to him, who first determination was that he was psychotic, he was paranoid, schizophrenic, and that he was criminally insane, which he was kind of offended by and surprised by. But the criminally insane factor, well, you think that, but you know, one of the challenges that we have with all kinds of crimes and the trials is closure. You know, people want to see the person responsible go to trial. Places that have, you know, the death penalty want the person executed. The young adult who shot up Parkland High School in Florida, he was sentenced to jail for life, and Florida has the death penalty. They kill people down there. And the people whose kids were killed were very angry that the jury didn't sentence him to death. He was just sentenced to jail. But that idea of we want somebody held accountable for it.
Yeah. So what does justice look like?
Exactly. What is justice? Right. So not surprisingly, there was another court conducted psychiatric examination that declared that he was sane. Mm-hmm. And so a year later, he was sane. Right. Exactly. And it was even appealed, and eventually he was found to be sane. What happened is it gave them an opportunity, right, to explore his whole political beliefs. And he had this massive missives that are all out there that everybody can follow, which is one of the reasons why he's become a cult figure, like the Columbine shooters, because there is documentation of what they espoused, whether they believed it or not. They're trying to invent a person who they aren't, and they want to become somebody. They're trying to, you know, throw any stone they can in the pond to make a ripple. And we saw that with the Columbine kids. So this case, this guy had this big, long missive, and he mailed it out to everybody. His whole mission was to send his political information out to the world. He emailed more than 1,000 people 90 minutes before the truck explosion.
90 minutes before the truck exploded. Oh, chilling.
Yeah, 90 minutes before. So it had gone out to all these people, and his primary thing in this writings that was more than, you know, 1,500 pages, what was brightly on display was his Islamophobic rhetoric.
Yeah. So white supremacist at the heart.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. He spent tons and tons of time writing and reading things that were all about this whole view. And, you know, it becomes confirmation bias. If you only surround yourself, you know, with the hate speak of whoever and right. have somebody agree yeah. with you, you begin to think that's the right way to think, and everybody else who doesn't think that way. And we've all experienced that in our political world.
Well, I mean, that's it. If you're on the wrong side of TikTok, you're on the wrong side of any social media channel, you'll only get confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm. Yep, very much so. Very much so. So it was really, really sad. This guy had long, long writings. He had filmed himself for YouTube, and he put that out before the shooting. I mean, he had prepped a long time. He thinks that his voice is so powerful and so important. He's advising that the Hindis in India should push the Muslims out of their country. His plan was that all Jews should be deported from Europe. Deported. You know, it's the kind of stuff that it's easy to say in somebody who just doesn't really understand life. And so he falls into his own trap. Think about somebody who sits and writes and videotapes all of the same stuff and becomes very obsessed with it. So then it becomes easier for him to say, and I'm going to be part of the solution. And that is where his perceived grievance with his country and the world begins to turn to action. And he begins to plan years ahead of time. He doesn't know exactly what he's planning for, but he's planning for something.
Well, that's it for part one. Join us next week for part two, when we delve into the mindset and motivations of the perpetrator and highlight the extensive preparations that he made, including the astounding lengths that he went to in order to acquire the weapons and explosives that he used in this horrific crime. If you can't wait or simply want to fuel the podcast with your support, then part two is available now on Apple Podcasts and patreon.com/stopthekilling. And don't forget to check out the video versions of the podcast on YouTube at Sarah Ferris Media. As always, the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening. And if you want to know more, Catherine's book, Stop the Killing, is out now. For more details, go to catherineschweit.com. Please consider also supporting our independently made podcast. It's simple to do. Go to patreon.com/stopthekilling. And for as little as the price of a latte a month, you can be part of the solution to stop the killing. Patreon rewards range from official do-gooder status to ad-free episodes, autographed books, and opportunities to connect with us directly for your business, school, church, or even just a book club chat. But just knowing that you are part of a movement that has the power to make your community safer, well, that's got to taste better than a skinny cappuccino any day. So please head to patreon.com/stopthekilling now and polish off your do-gooder halo and make sure to include your name so we can give you a shout out. This podcast is a Community podcast production. That's Con with an N. If you want more content, then head over to Community Podcast at Instagram, where you'll find trailers on more binge-worthy true crime, like the award-winning podcast Conning the Con. And check out our show notes for all the links mentioned. Finally, if you want one takeaway action that you can do right now that can help make our community safer, please share, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. Everybody needs to know that they hold the keys to see something and say something. Together, we can stop the killing.
It's one of those things you hope never happens, but you better train for it, because it will happen, and it will happen in places you wouldn't expect. Be ready for it.
Welcome to the Bravery Academy. My name is Emma Ferris and I'm your host. This podcast is crafted to share the stories of courageous individuals who have overcome adversity and found the courage to live their best lives. We'll explore the science of well-being, courage and connection, and interview top thought leaders, game changers and survivors. And it's from these stories that we learn what resilience is, how to heal, how to recover, and how to be brave.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth, and together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together, we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loops Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.